Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Thanks for listening to the Not a Diving podcast. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our private Discord server, sign up at patreon.com/scubaofficial.
This is Not a Diving podcast. With Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving podcast. Okay, I'm going to keep this very short for reasons which I will detail in the show notes. So yeah, take a look at the show notes and I'll write down exactly why I'm keeping this brief. On the show this week, we have Machine Woman. So Machine Woman is a really great producer. She's released on labels including Ninja Tune's Technicolor, Peter Manafelt's label, and most recently Delsin. The release on Delsin is really, really great, actually. And yeah, I'm a big fan of her music. And she's just obviously a bit of a character. She comes up with these tune titles like I Want to Fuck Tech House and I Got Tech House Tattooed on My Butt. And I think she is able to identify the idiosyncrasies and absurdities of the dance scene in quite an accurate way and sends them up in a way which I think is quite unusual in a scene which is very often pretty po-faced and takes itself like way too seriously, I think is probably a fair characterization. So yeah, great to have her on. We talk about her experiences coming from Russia, moving to the UK as a young person, and eventually landing in a place where, yeah, she's making some really great music. So yeah, this was a fun conversation and I think you're going to enjoy it. So let's get into it, shall we? Without further delay, here is Machine Woman. Machine Woman, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for inviting me, Paul.
Yeah, thanks for coming. So first question, what is so great about The League of Gentlemen?
Oh my God, how... I didn't expect this question at all. You took me a bit back by surprise. And I think it was from one interview I did once and I mentioned my mother really liked it. I don't know how you got to that interview. I don't even know where.
I am impeccably researched for all of these episodes.
Clearly. I don't know. I think it was obscure British sense of humor that my mom liked and she was showing it to me. And I think it was during the time where I didn't speak English.
Right.
Because I learned to speak English when I was 14, when I moved to UK. And I just didn't understand what the hell is going on that show. But, you know, getting to know English culture close and personal, I start getting some points of it, but still, I think I didn't expect you to ask me about that, so I was not prepared, I'm not gonna lie.
No, I mean, it's always piques my interest when it comes up, you know. It doesn't come up that much. It's so unique, I think, even in the context of British comedy, which is, you know, irreverent quite a lot of the time. But The League of Gentlemen is something different, right? It's very strange.
I agree with you 100%. I don't watch it now. I think my comedy choices have changed quite a lot. So I can give you an example who I'm a big fan of.
Go on.
Limmy. Do you know Limmy from Scotland?
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
That's my kind of comedy now. I think that's what I dig. That's what I spend my time Especially during pandemic, he was doing a lot of Twitch streams. And he's basically, I don't know if, who I was listening, if you don't know who we're talking about, is this British obscure comedian, Lemmy. And he had a Lemmy show on BBC and also BBC Scotland. And he was streaming. He's a professional streamer now. I think he puts himself more as a streamer than a comedian.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, every day, apart from, I think, weekend, but occasionally we get treated to a weekend stream. And he plays games. And one of the games he plays is truck driving. So he literally drives for hours. And that's how I passed pandemic. It's really? I was watching hours and hours of Lemmy trucking.
Wow.
It was, yeah, inspirational.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you said BBC Scotland, but he's very, very much Scottish. This nothing not Scottish about Lemmy, I think.
Very much so, yeah.
Right, so you grew up in Russia though, right? But you moved in when you were 14. I didn't realize you were so young when you first moved to the UK.
Yeah, it seemed like so long ago. Yeah, I was born in St. Petersburg. It used to be called Leningrad the time I was born, many years ago, as I mentioned. And I moved to UK at the age of 14.
Right, so what was it that brought you to the UK? And what year was that though, to locate that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, that was... No, this is unavoidable though, because this is the years are a kind of key thing here. The time periods are important. So,
you're very well prepared of how presenting and how to go around some maybe uncomfortable questions, but you can take it out of people. But yeah, of course, I'm not in any way hiding my age. So that was in 1997, which, just in case, to do a math, it makes me 40 years old. What brought me over? I think life brought me over
right.
from Russia to here.
Okay. Can you be more specific? Because I mean, I assumed you came over to go to university, but obviously you were far too young to do that at that point. Presumably you moved over with your mum?
I did. And I think further we go into the conversation, it might become more clear why I have moved.
Okay, so. That's cryptic. Okay, well, so it's up to me to try and dig in, find this piece of information. I'm absolutely fascinated by Russia and people who grew up in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Because there seems to be, well, I don't know if this is true. I mean, I identify a really distinctive, I don't know how to put this, a distinctive attitude from people who I've met who grew up in Russia. And actually in this kind of period, almost everyone I know from Russia has grown up in that kind of, I guess, transitional period from the, you know, the Soviet Union into all the awful stuff that happened in the 90s in Russia. But obviously moving at that point of life, I mean, that's a quite a lot of your formative experiences, anyone's formative experiences happen, you know, between the ages of 14 and 18 or whatever. So, I mean, how do you see yourself? I mean, you must see yourself as almost British at this point.
Yeah, this is very interesting conversation, and I like how you start your podcast straight into that with Russia.
I mean, like I said, I find this topic absolutely so interesting. So yeah, please.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people currently, especially the past 2 years, also find Russia very interesting to talk about. But we're going back to my age of 14 when I moved. It was basically like moving from St. Petersburg, big city, to a small town in East Midlands. And I remember when I arrived to Heathrow Airport and when we took bus to go to the town, and I seen people living in houses, you know, detached houses or semi-detached houses. Mm. And I thought, this is hell. Like, because I grew up living in high rise, in blocks, projects. And I was like, this is not normal. What are people doing here? This is really not normal. And of course, many cities have high rises, but where I went, it's like tiny little town and was like semi-detached houses. So that was culture shock from beginning. And then because not speaking English and being put into very English school, and East Midlands also depends where you go in UK, you have different dialects. And to me,
sure,
I didn't know English before, and when I heard the English in this Midlands, I was like, what language is that? So yeah, it was, I would say, traumatic experience in some way, because you kind of be taken away from everything you knew and every comfort, and you just start finding yourself into another way. So you're kind of restarting yourself. And yeah, I guess it's really formed me for the rest of my life. But coming back to your questions about do I feel almost British, I see Russia as my biological mother, who maybe kind of separated from me. And I see UK, England specifically, as my adoptive mother who welcomed me. And I do feel more like all my friends. Like I don't have friends from childhood in Russia. It just happened that way. Yeah, I do feel more associated with British culture and UK specifically, England.
So you were in Nottingham, were you, when you first moved over?
Like Nottinghamshire. Right. It's a small town outside Nottingham.
Wow. I mean, how did you end up there? What was the connection?
Oh, Paul, you're still like digging, and I have to maybe at some point admit I'm maybe a spy, and I don't want to do that, so.
That wouldn't be very spyish behavior to let the information out at such a early.
How many spies have you met in your life?
Well, that's the thing. You don't know, do you? I have no idea, because you never know when you meet a spy.
Exactly. So, but this is pretty much, yeah, I found myself in a small town in UK and East Midlands, and start learning about English culture, and my world has changed dramatically. Everything has changed.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, so you didn't speak a word. So you had to go to school without speaking a word of English, really.
Yeah, that was fun. Imagine.
At the age of 14 as well. Yeah, Jesus.
Yeah, that was just kind of hell. It was like teenage years on top of, yeah, being in school. And yeah, it was not fun for me. But at the same time, I look back and, you know, it was kind of interesting experience, but very strange. Like everything was strange.
Yeah, I'm sure. Particularly there. I mean, you're right to say that the different areas of the UK have very very specific individual cultures, actually. I mean, obviously you have the accents, but there's there's individual identities that go with them. And yeah, that part of the country is, I mean, for our non-British listeners, like the East Midlands, that was like hardcore Brexit country. Like the East Midlands voted very, very solidly, if I'm not mistaken, for Brexit.
I think it was a big change. I was watching some interviews, some of local people at the time when it happened. I was living in Berlin. Was it 2016 Brexit?
Yeah.
Brexit actually happened. Yeah. And yeah, people were just fed up with the current situation and were like, I don't care. I'm just going to vote against what I used to vote for. So, and it did change. But I think it's still a mixture, like Nottinghamshire. It's kind of, yeah, it was one of the main areas who drastically voted out. But I think if you look at whole map of UK and the Brexit vote outside London, that was probably you see a lot of people voting out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly outside the big cities, most places
exactly
were like that for sure. So but you went to uni in London, is that right?
Yes, I went to university, Westminster University. Yeah, it was London and Harrow, because it was I did mixed media, fine art, and yeah, just to add how big is London, it was taking me 1 hour to get to uni and then 1 hour to get back home. So I might as well have lived in Nottingham and I'll be quicker right to get to university. But yeah, I did.
Right, and you did fine art. That's interesting, because I mean, I always read about you being a multimedia artist, but I'm only familiar with your music. Mm. So tell me about that. Tell me about the visual side of stuff for you.
I think I applied to about five of the most famous art school in London because I thought, oh, I need to go to London. And I wanted to get out from where I was, like Nottinghamshire, because I was just like, this is not for me. I don't feel I belong here, or maybe not like I belong here, but I wanted something more and meet more people as well, in the same way as what my interests were in creative art and music. So yeah, I applied and I had this art book where I did some drawings. It was very basic. You know, when you go to uni at younger age, I don't think it's, you don't really know what you want to do. You just go to uni because everyone does.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think people go far too young. I think you should go when you're 22 or 23 or something like that, you know, or even older, you know.
Maybe even older, because after I have finished, I was like, oh, I wish I did something else, and I wish I did this, and now I have interest in that. So it was basically applying to art school because it was the easiest way for me at the time, and not knowing exactly what I want to do. But I was like, I'm creative, I'm kind of musical. So yeah, well, I mean, it was kind of obvious choice. So I applied, and I remember going to a few interviews, and literally, and I think it was one, I can't remember which university, but it was experimental sound production or something like that. I was late for interview. I showed up and we're like, so tell us about yourself. And I was like, I'm playing in noise bands. And we're like, everyone on our course does. And it's very exciting. I was so like, I would not take me onto the course. And that's what I thought. They said to me, like, do you want to go and see the campus? I was like, not really, kind of, it's a campus. And then 2 days later, we made me an offer to go there. And I was like, what, really? But I didn't go to that uni. I went to Westminster, and I guess it was mixed media fine art because it was a bit of everything. And that's what I wanted to do, a bit of everything in a creative way. So I could do music, I could do photography, I could do painting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and it was kind of semi-interesting, but at the same time, my experience was like, I'll forget my homework, and then we'll have like, you know, I forgot how it's called when people say, oh, today we're going to judge, not judge, we're going to evaluate and give feedback of a work, like we set you a task.
Yep.
And I will put down like a bag from Asda, empty bag from Asda, and we're like, oh, this is art. I'm like, no, it's not. I literally like, I didn't do work. And my teacher's like, no, you're an artist. I'm like, maybe I am. I don't know.
You mentioned that you were playing in bands by the time you were applying to uni. So at what point did you get interested in music? Like, were you playing instruments from when you were young and all that kind of stuff?
I wasn't playing anything in Russia, but in UK, I remember getting into Nirvana, and then also into Slipknot. So when Nirvana came first, I bought bass guitar. I saved, like, I had like some Saturday job in a bakery, so I saved money and I bought bass guitar. And then I bought a drum kit as well.
Really? Wow, that must have been unpopular with your everyone else in the household.
Yeah, and I did it. I bought the drum kit, and it was like Nottingham Drum Center, and I bought this, like, I bought double bass pedal as well because I really wanted to be like Slipknot. And I came to my mom after actual fact I bought it, and we were bringing it over, and I said, mom, I have to tell you something. She was like, oh my god, what it is? I was like, god, I bought a drum kit. And she was like, you what? Like, I bought a drum kit. And she's like, okay, this is not going to happen. But I got allocated a little space in my family garage, so they put me there, and I would listen Slipknot on cassettes, on this cassette player I bought from Argos, and I would play badly. I don't know, maybe like not even playing, imitating some kind of sounds on drum kit with double bass pedal and not garage. So yeah, it was fun times.
Nice. Wow.
So that was the first playing instruments. But to be honest, I don't play anything, but I play everything. And what I'm saying is, I like making sounds. I don't have music theory, I don't know notes, potentially I can't, you know, really, yeah, I can't read music, I can't really do music, but I do music, and it doesn't stop me playing music around the world. Maybe some kind of like paradox in that, you know. I just like making sounds, and if it sounds good to me, that's good enough. And if people like it, it's okay. But if we don't, well, you know, it's okay.
Sure. I mean, I think production and actually, I mean, not just production, you know, there's, I think the history of the last 40 or even 50 years of music has been characterized by people who are musically extremely competent, but don't necessarily have a lot of technical or, you know, theoretical knowledge at all, mm-hmm. actually. I mean, in my conversation with Adrian Sherwood, actually, I mean, he's basically just said exactly the same thing as you just said, you know, and he's literally, you know, he's one of the people who's been most cited by my other guests as musical influence, right? So I don't think it's not a handicap at all, really. I mean, having said that, though, you know, in my conversation with MJ Cole, who is very much a classically trained person, I think basically if you are classically trained, you'll say that it's good. And then if you're not, then you'll be like, well, I don't, you know, I think people kind of default to their own experience. But I mean, at the end of the day, it's like, it's the output, I think, really that matters, right? And how you get there isn't really important.
Yeah, I remember when I started making electronic music, so that came later after playing in bands and just being fed up of having other people in bands and not doing what you want to do.
Hang on a second, let me ask you about that. So were you frustrated at the lack of direct control? Because I mean, I have to say that was my experience with bands. I was like, why don't you just do what I tell you to do?
Okay, how it was, I moved to London to go to uni and I wanted to play in a band. I had my bass guitar, so I would go on Gumtree and start looking for people wanting to have bass player. And because I was into experimental noise punk bands or something that sound maybe between My Bloody Valentine, Sonic Youth, Massive Attack, that kind of sound, to a bit more punky stuff. And I would answer some ads, or I put an ad, and you get, you go somewhere in Camden into a rehearsal room, and it's usually like four dudes and you, and we all want to be Sonic Youth. So you already fit in, whatever you play it or not. So I played in so many bands.
Well, they all wanted a girl to play bass, basically. Was that it?
Yeah, Bloody Valentine, Sonic Youth.
Yeah, Smashing Pumpkins, you know.
Exactly. So, and I was frustrated with the fact that I was not musically connecting with people. I'm not saying we were somehow like horrible people, no. I'm saying it's like musically wasn't there, but because I was just starting to discover what's it like. Occasionally you'll jam and you're like, oh, it's kind of working, okay, I'm kind of feeling it, oh, we're gonna play a gig, okay, cool. But then the more I start auditioning for bands or audition other people for bands, and I realize it's actually such a, it's almost like finding marriage, you know, you're finding someone you're falling in love with, and it's the chemistry, it's so rare where you musically connect. But I did connect with three people, I think, when I was playing more like in bands. And when there was connection, it was so beautiful. Like, I would not know how to do some specific notes, and the person more able musically, but also connection on chemistry level, musical chemistry level, compatibility, mm-hmm. could tell what I'm playing, and it just like worked and it was all good. So it was beautiful moments, but it taught me a lesson. It takes so long to find someone you can collaborate with. And I think I take this as well with electronic music. I have jammed with some of the like the best people in industry. Some of them my friends, the people who are touring DJs, live music producers, but it's not always gelling. Even I love the music and it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a magic to it, you know, for collaboration.
Yeah, there absolutely is. Yeah, I've always found it very difficult, actually. But when it does happen, it's amazing, right? It's unlike anything else, almost.
Yes,
it really is. But you're absolutely right. Yeah, it's rare to find someone who you genuinely click with in that kind of respect, for sure.
Yeah, on creative collaboration level. Actually, today I was reading Wikipedia about you, Paul.
Okay.
And yeah, what I read about, being in bands and playing guitar. Mm. And I think anyone who follows you on Instagram or any social media have seen either your cats or you playing guitar. So
yeah, there was a period where I used to post guitar clips, but that doesn't really happen anymore. But that was
why not? I we all miss it, you know. We want the guitar.
But... I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think the world was only good for a certain number of Guns N' Roses solos on my Instagram stories.
I enjoyed it.
I mean, maybe. I've got two guitars hanging up my shoe. I'm looking at them right now, and I haven't played either of them for ages. So yeah, maybe at some point.
I have inspired you. So, world, be prepared for more Guns N' Roses solos from Paul on his socials. It's incoming.
Yeah. So, what was the best band you were in, would you say? Was there one that was better than the others?
There was a few projects I really enjoyed. I think one was CCSB, and it was this guy. I found he was very quiet, and he brought computer and some controllers with him, and I was playing drums or sometimes bass. And he was making really interesting, weird sounds. And I was like, okay, we're going to direction of this where I want to be. And we played actually Shoreditch Church. It was a festival, and it was like kind of dark wave electronic festival. It was so long ago. We opened up, and it was quite fun. But the thing is, like halfway through, before we start playing, the power got cut off. And because this guy I'm in a band with, he's very into his technology. And he basically helped the festival to go on because he sorted out what was happening. But no one who was involved in the festival could find out where it was broken. But he's like, I need to save this place. I'm like, okay, off you go. So yeah, that was a fun project. And because it was so mixed as well, I mean, like there's electronic parts with live drums and bass guitar, but there's lots of effects. Like I had like rat pedal. I also have, just actually next to me, rat pedal I sold because I think I passed my punk days. but I have this V20 Boss pedal, which is like a vocal looper, but it has effects. So... used a lot of that. And after that, I was really into Massive Attack, Portishead.
Yeah.
And I remember I was working in Prince Charles Cinema.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And everyone who employed there, usually creative students. And I met this girl, Melissa. She played guitar. And I was like, oh, I hear you play guitar. She's like, yeah, I do. It's like, oh, I play bass and do a bit of like spoken word stuff. Do you want to jam? She's like, yeah, sure, come to my house. And that's when, you know, we're talking about chemistry. Was it like instant love chemistry musically? What happened? And that project was called Female Band.
Right.
And people's like, female, female band. And yeah, it was influenced by, Massive Attack, Portishead. And that was really beautiful experience. But I think... being creative, being an artist, you can maybe put your ego above everything else. And I dismantle the band. I wanted to be solo. And I do regret that. But at the same time, we're still friends, like me and Melissa are friends. But also she's doing other things, non-musical things. And I'm doing musical things, but not related directly to playing in bands. So yeah, but that's two projects I really like, CCSB and Female Band. And you can actually find Female Band on SoundCloud and listen to what it sounds like.
Right. Cool. Nice. Yeah. I mean, you know, as you mentioned there, like there's kind of two sides to, I mean, it's one thing making a tune with someone, but actually having a project which is going to, you know, potentially grow into something which is, you know, a career in quotation marks. I mean, you know, it's so hard, I think, to find the combination. Like I said, it's hard to find someone that you can collaborate with musically, but then someone who can collaborate with musically and also like live with, essentially, because I guess that's what it is when you're in an act together. You spend so much time, you know, once you're touring hard and all the rest of it, like, and even before you get to that point, I mean, the kind of most, I guess, quote unquote, successful band that I was in, it really fell apart because we all just hated each other, basically. We were a pretty good band, but I mean, yeah, the personalities were not compatible at all.
But I think it's a lot of time, if you look at it as like, yeah, having a relationship with someone, but if you look at it as a collaboration and respect of personal boundaries, and when everyone also respect the project you're doing, it's a different way. But that comes years later. Like now, if I'm forming a band, I have so much more idea what I want to do and how it is, and finding someone who's on equal level and understanding. But then, you know, when you get in the band, yeah, of course, it's like, it's a fun idea. You're going to go on tour and it's like, you're going to be big and you're going to be playing like Glastonbury and like having a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you're all like in your early 20s and just have no
idea. Exactly. Exactly. So it's very different to if you formed a band now, you know, very different. But to do any projects, like, you know, you obviously have more experience in music as well and you understand how it works more, but at the time you don't. So that's why people look at it as like a relationship, and so many relationships fall apart. And if I look at it as business project, maybe it would be a very different way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, yeah, the fact that it tends to involve people who are young and not fully developed mentally, it doesn't really help.
But still finding themselves, still developing. So when you...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
You might like something now, but you have changed like within a matter of a few like months, or some experiences change you and you're like, this is not what I want, but you're still maybe learning how to communicate. And if you can't communicate in a way your other half or your partner or your business partner or your bandmates communicate, then obviously that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, the exceptions are amazing. I mean, I'm just thinking about like a band like Metallica, who have literally been been in a band since they were like 18 together, and what are they now, like nearly 60? That's mind-blowing to me. It really is.
But you know, I think it also depends how far you go and how quickly, because when you end up, once you being recognized, like Arctic Monkeys, you know, once you being recognized at something that makes money, you have people come around you who potentially will be able to offer to keep you in a place and advise you things. So, and
well, that can go one of two ways, can't it? It can be very bad. But like,
no, of course. Yeah. But we're talking about big successful bands, so I'm pretty sure it was a team coming on board pretty quickly, or as soon as we've been found out, and there's some kind of boundaries placed how to drive a project further. So maybe like project management for a band, you know?
I mean, must be examples, yeah, of that happening in a positive way and making it good. Did you watch the Robbie Williams documentary on Netflix, the one that came out recently?
I haven't. Should I?
That's fascinating. It really is. Yeah, because obviously he was in Take That when he was like 16. Mm-hmm. And just in terms of like, you know, those sorts of experiences when you're super young and you become surrounded by people, you know, because when you are successful, yeah, okay, there's people that come on board who are going to be professional and you know, help everyone make money, because just, you know, that's what it's all about at the end of the day.
Exactly.
But there's also, you know, so many like bad influences too. When, you know, the more famous you get, like the more people just want a piece of you, don't they? I suppose, you know, so it must be extremely difficult. I think
it's, again, depends what kind of team you have of you at the beginning, who is the first person to find you,
yeah,
and be with you and drive your career forward and protect you against specific elements that are very common happen in all kind of industries, like, yeah, being mistreated or being used or being signed a contract when you sign all your rights away, etc. So if you don't have someone to advise that, or if someone promised you something that you don't understand and you're very young, but also not very young people as well who become successful had that issues too.
Sure.
But I think it all depends on the team. But I will check it out, the Robbie Williams.
No, it's surprisingly good. And he comes across, yeah, well, I wasn't expecting much. I was expecting him to be I was never really a Robbie Williams fan, but
I heard you were a big Robbie Williams fan.
Well, you know, I like Take That, but you know, not so much, not so much for me. No, I do recommend it though. So tell me about your, you know, solo career then, like in terms of moving into it and getting to the to the point where you're, you know, making 1,000 tracks in 6 months, as you apparently do.
I do. Let me say it again. I said it in every interview, because once I said that in Resident Advisor, do you know how much hate I got for that? And people like,
so much hate.
But the fact is, I never said I make good 1,000 tracks. I said I made 1,000 tracks, because I literally...
Key distinction, yeah.
But I guess it's really triggered some people. And instead of concentrating, say, okay, why can't I do 1,000 tracks? They find like, well, the problem is she's making 100,000 tracks. So the problem must be somebody else. So a lot of times people try to... something internally we're not happy about, to place it on external trigger or reason. So all the hate was like, I remember one comment was like, where she's going to be in 10 years time or 5 years time or something like that. She's still going to be making music. I'm like, mate, I've been making music since I found Slipknot in 2001. So I mean, I'll still be making music, whatever Resident Advisor writes about me or not, I'll still be making music, because that's what I have done for the past nearly 20 years. But we don't see that. We see what media writes and what triggers them. And that's what reaction created. But yeah, so again, for the point, I do make a lot of music. And at the point I had more time, I was making 1,000 tracks 6 months. But I never said they were good tracks. They were just my tracks and I enjoyed it. So I just want to say that, but maybe we're actually very good. I just play myself down a bit, you know, just to keep people not hating me as much as they did on that Resident Advisor article, you know.
1,000 masterpieces in 6 months. That's impressive. I'm impressed.
But I can tell you how that happens as well. Like, people maybe don't understand the process, but process is very easy. And if I tell you how, it's like a secret, and you have to sign up to my introductory offer, which costs £50. I'm joking. No, it's all how process, how you work. Like, if you have obviously hardware, it would be in a very different way. I use a lot of software, which is very quick process for me. And I don't overthink. I don't think I'm going to make specific thing. I just go and like, yeah, it's like fun. It's like, to me, it's like literally like brushing teeth. It's just everyday practice. And sometimes it comes out something nice. Sometimes it doesn't. I just don't think about it too much.
Right.
That's what I think, people overthink about it. And we want to think what other people will think about what we create. I never started from that point, because as I mentioned before, I can't read music. I'm not really a musical person, professional, like, or classically trained, or I know that. So I never started a point of, I'm making something and people will enjoy it because I have the skill or what have you. I start doing it because I enjoyed it and I did it for me, and I still doing it for me. And if someone likes it, okay. But if you don't, also okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think the expectation of other people is just the worst thing you can possibly let in to the process.
Yeah. Or even trying to make something so other people will like. So if you want to sign a specific label, you will make something that sounds like that. So it almost doesn't come from really from you, but you're trying to fit onto that label.
Yeah.
And a lot of times it could be good because you're fitting into style of a label, but I think it will miss like the part of the true creativity. And sometimes it just doesn't connect, you know?
Totally, totally. I think there's... it can be a sort of a slightly delicate balance between taking inspiration from something and being influenced by something to doing what you've just described, which is just, you know, I'm going to make something like this, which is, I think intention is a big part of it. You know, if you go in with the intention of like, okay, this is going to be that, then that's not a healthy way, I think, to go about things and to, you know, to kind of execute your, whatever you're trying to do creatively. But, you know, at the same time, everyone's in, you know, influenced by everything around them, you know, and it's very possible to be, you know, directly influenced by something and to still, you know, be true to your creative instincts. Do you think, is that fair?
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot of times I see when people ask for demos, or we give call out like, oh, you know, we're accepting demos or send us music, but we always say like, just don't copy like our artist or Don Cop, just be you. Like, there's so much time I heard this said, and people just like, just don't. And a lot of times, label owners, and you can tell me if it's true, because you're a label owner yourself. A lot of times, label owners will like so much different kind of music, and we don't want to hear like the same sound. We're just looking for something else that excites them.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's nothing worse than being sent stuff where it's obvious that, you know, it's been made with you in mind, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that doesn't happen quite so much these days, because I think we've been quite varied in what we've been putting out the last few years. But there was definitely a period where we had much more of a sound to the label, and we would just get sent loads and loads of stuff of, you know, people just obviously ripping off that sound, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, ripping off is a bit harsh. It's a bit of a harsh way to put it. They're just trying to fit in with that sound, I suppose. And to some extent, that's okay, I suppose. But I suppose equally, it's usually quite obvious, you know, the stuff which is, like I said, taking inspiration from something or just trying to copy it. You know, that usually comes through quite strongly.
Yeah.
In the music. And I guess what you get used to after a certain period of A&Ring and listening to things, those sorts of things become quite obvious quite quickly, you know.
I think it's fitting in. If you write fit, it's coming from you, and fitting in, when you're trying to fit in, you are changing yourself for something. That's the difference, you know, because you can go out and find something that really fits to your label.
Sure.
But if people send you demos that to fit in, and it becomes, yeah, a different way, I guess. And I don't know, music is, you know, people send me some stuff and I'm like, oh, you know, this is not for my label, because I run the label Takeover Jazz Records. But it's definitely like, I hear the sound of so and so and so and so, why do you approach them? So maybe sometimes also people just send it to everyone, and whoever like picks them, it will be good. But yeah.
So, okay. Tell me about Machine Woman, how it started. Where does the name come from?
Okay, so I was performing as a female band, even that, but I started changing my sound towards more electronic. So I was playing bass and pedals, but when I got a sampler, when I started using Ableton and start producing music, more electronic sound. And I went to play one show in Salford, and I was in this abandoned warehouse and had no roof. And I was so scared. I was like, half of the roof was caved in, and half was like, and we put massive like bass system in there. And I was like, every time bass played, I was like, okay, I'm going to die here. Like, listening to this like experimental weird bass music. But that's like changed a lot. And I was like, okay, I'm going to, like, this is doesn't fit female band. This is something else. Like, I don't know. It's completely like I morphed into a new project inside me. And Machine Woman, I guess it come from Terminator. I really like Terminator. And I think it was like one of the right. first films I've seen. And it was like very impressive how Arnie, he's very like metallic underneath. Like, you know,
right.
The man exterior, he's very metallic, and there's just the music as well, you know, when he's driving around like in a car, like his red eye or on motorcycle or something like that. So
yeah.
It's that. And also I once saw a film Metropolis.
I
like that vision of the metallic woman. The figure, metallic robotic figure sitting there. And also I was thinking more conceptually about Machine Woman. It's like, it's a woman, or it's a human being, but woman, but doesn't have any emotions.
Yeah.
And making electronic music, it was kind of coming in into like computer music. So, and making with Ableton a lot of stuff, or like samples or instruments you use, it's almost like computer makes the music for you. And a lot of times. Mm. So it's like, yeah, it's a very complex situation happened with change of the name, and my music influences as well start changing. I wanted to create more darker sound. And I remember playing with Rame, and I was like, wow, I went to see them.
Right, yeah.
They actually played with Mal Kimby at South Bank, I think like years ago, and they had like this film, and the music was like two figures on stage with two computers. We're in the darkness, and it was like a very like dark bass, like experimental stuff. I was like, I want to make that. This is incredible. And then I got to play support them in Scotland, and I was just like, yeah, this is the head in, and the change of name and change of direction. And then I guess I moved to Manchester because, yeah, playing a gig. I also played in Islington Mill. Now it's changed, but it was like a club. So it was like a lot of experimental techno music. I mean, the whole Manchester has a really incredible music scene. Mm. I really loved it. I went to some really incredible parties. I've seen incredible artists there. And that was really my more like introduction into rave and techno scene. And also, like, you know, Regis is not far away from there, you know, so like really close by. And that's then I start thinking as like Berghain. You know what? I want to move to Berlin and go to Berghain every day. So I did that, but I didn't go to Berghain every day. In fact, first year in Berlin, I didn't go single time to Berghain. I was just like, this is Berlin. This is like, what the hell is this? But yeah, it was my whole thing. I was like, I'm going to go there where techno lives. In my head, I was living there. You know, it's questionable where it lives, but yeah. And I went there.
What year was that you moved to Berlin?
That was 2015.
Right. That was just when I left, actually. I left in 2015.
Yeah. It was like peak time. I guess for anyone who moves to Berlin, it's always a peak time. You know, for me, it was 2015 when I moved there.
Yeah.
And then I'm pretty sure if someone moving to Berlin now, it's a peak time for them. Because also the sound is very different in techno, I think, now. So it's like the peak time of now is different.
Yeah. So how much time had you spent there before you moved over?
I went to a Tonal Festival when it just restarted. And I think it was 2011 or 2012, something like that, maybe 15. And I was a couple of times before. And I didn't really, it was not for music. It was before my techno days. But I think it was more, my decision was influenced by present, what I was, and everyone talked about Berlin. And I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to move there. And I did.
And are you still living there, actually?
No, I live in London.
Right. Yeah. So go on then. Tell me about your time in Berlin. Because, I mean, as I said, that was just when I left. So I had very much fallen out of love with Berlin by the time I left. But, I mean, obviously, as you said, like for anyone moving there, it's unbelievably exciting, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, maybe right now it's a little bit more post-Brexit for anyone from UK moving over. That's a little bit different. I mean, it's majorly different. Mm-hmm. But before it was obviously a very different situation. It was exciting. I went there, connected to local community, found friends really quickly. I guess maybe like party scene, music scene, expat scene, and basically everyone in London, in Berlin, who was there like for the same reason as I am, to be a DJ and to to right, work in a call center, right? You know, this is the two things. So that's exactly, I tick these boxes. Or work in startup, you know, I started in call center and startup, and then startup we had the fund cut. Like, it happens a lot. Mm-hmm. And what I noticed, because I was also actively making music and sending out demos, so I had like release on Where To Now Records, and then I had release on Peter Manifold Production.
Yep.
And then the gig offers start coming in, and by the time I finish my work at startup, I was like, oh, I need to find another job. And then a gig comes in. And at the time, Berlin was, for me, I could survive on like 600 euros a month. My rent was very cheap, and I don't need a lot of money to survive. So one gig comes in, then second comes in. I was like, oh, I have two gigs this month, and one is a festival, so that's enough for me for 2 months. And then it's kind of start rolling from there. And when Dean Bryce, he was A&R at Ninja Tune Technicolor, and we connected on SoundCloud probably like a year or two before, because I'm a really big fan of Actress. And I think SoundCloud algorithm recommended me this producer called Photo Machine, which was Dean, and he still sometimes produced under that name. And I connected, I think I wrote to him and said, I love your music, really like cool, and you're friends with actress. And we met actually in London in his studio and like get on. And he was like, do you want to do release for Technicolor? I was like, not really. No, I don't think it's my kind of sound or anything. He was like, it's going to be fun. I was like, okay, okay, maybe. So I sent him some demos. And he was like, okay, I just need one more track to make the complete release. And I was like, oh, I don't have anything, but he wants something. He wants it by the morning. Okay, let me just jump something out 1,000 tracks later.
Yeah, right. I made pick out one of those, you know, few hundred that you've been working
exactly,
on.
Exactly, exactly. So I made Camille from Om Makes Me Feel Loved. And
right.
I think you know Om is the club inside Trezor, like the next door, like Om.
Yeah. Sure.
That's where I used to go. That was my favorite club to go there. And Camille was the girl who was working on the door. So I made this track and then in the morning sent him a bunch of tracks, including this one. He was like, this is it. I'm like, really? I didn't even think he'll like it. And then the release happened on NinjaTune, and that's kind of like really set me off to be a full-time musician, live performer for like a few years. And yeah, and then pandemic happened. Kind of a lot of like I moved back, but also I lived in Italy for a little bit, but that's like maybe that's for another episode. But
yeah, hang on a sec. Tell me a bit more about like Berlin in particular, though, because I mean, what's your perception of it, of how it's changed? Because I mean, I think it did change between, you know, when you're saying when you first went there, even if you weren't necessarily, you know, involving yourself in the scene. But like, what's your sense of how the place has changed maybe in the last, say, 10 years or so since, you know, you became acquainted with it?
I don't know, because I feel like I was in the passing, so I can't really say. I feel I didn't give enough. Like, I'm like you, I fall out of love with Berlin. So I was like, okay, you know, Brexit happened. I just, you know, I don't feel cultural connection here. I don't feel like I'm really have to be here, so I moved out.
Let me just interrupt you. What's the exact significance of Brexit there that you're referring to?
I think it was maybe I took it as a sign for me to go as well. I don't know. You know, really? I haven't really thought about it in that context of a detail, but I kind of thought, you know, I've been here 4 years. You know, because by the time I left it was like 2019 or something. And I was like, yeah, I think I just leave because I'm just not really fitting in.
And do you mean leave as in I need to go back to the UK?
Not necessarily UK. I wanted, but yeah, in a way, yeah, I think, yeah, it was UK. But when I got to UK and I got bored and I was like, okay, I'm going back. But I stopped by Italy. And then I thought, you know what? I think I really miss Germany. I miss how my life was there, but no, I'm not talking about party scene, but like other things. Like, you know, sometimes you appreciate things when they've gone from your life and you actually see the true value to you in things when they've gone.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And by the time I wanted to come back, it was kind of, things changed.
Yeah.
And I couldn't. So I don't know. I can't really answer your question and say how I've seen this change. It's like there's always new people coming in and out, and it's always the same idea. Someone comes in, sublets a room, trying to find somewhere to live, trying to find a job, trying to find like part-time job, trying to be a DJ, trying to be a producer, get into the scene, music scene. That's what my part was like. You know, I'm not saying this is like everyone's experience, but how it was for me. And it was kind of ongoing, the same circle, but I think because I was in that circle, so that's why it was like constant, like that for me.
Yeah,
so I haven't really, because I didn't really involve myself into Germany, I can't really say how it's changed. I think you really need to learn language and be part of a local community in more detail.
Sure.
And I wasn't, so I can't really say. I can't say.
Okay, fair enough. So I'm going to read you a quote from you, And I want to...
From me?
I want to ask you about it. I've actually got two quotes. One is from you, one is from someone else. But I'm going to read you yours first.
Okay.
Okay, quote. This is an ongoing battle. I say battle because it is. Claiming your space in a male-dominated sphere is not easy. Tell me about that.
When did I say that?
I'm going to guess, I don't know, I didn't write it down. It's from an interview. Maybe, I don't know, most of the interviews I read with you were from before the pandemic. So maybe around the time we're talking about, actually.
I think it's, so what is your question again? Sorry, I just want to digest it a little bit more.
I just want to know about what you may have meant and think about that stuff now.
Male-dominated spaces. Is that what the question about?
Claiming your space in a male-dominated sphere is not easy. I guess claiming your space, that's the interesting bit, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it's fitting in. And if you're walking into a room and you don't see anyone in the room who represents who you are, you find intimidation. It depends how you feel, obviously, and how you are being brought up or how you've been told to behave by society. So maybe that's what I'm referring to. And I guess now, maybe with age, maybe with experience and seeing people and also seeing how things work, I still feel there is dominance in any industry. But I guess there is a way, what my input, like I start concentrating on what I can offer and building my own space. Mm-hmm. Sometimes if, this is going to sound so cheesy, if you knock on every door, but like no one answering the doors, you can give up or you can start building your own door, your own space.
Yeah, sure.
And
sure.
Your own community. So I think I see it more what I can change about it rather what I can talk about it. So very pragmatic approach now. And that's what I've been doing, really. I, you know, doing my own label, doing my own thing, doing my own meetup, because even what I did as well, and it might not be related specifically to this quote, but I always wanted to work in a record store, always. And every time I apply, and they're just like, people like, no. You're not coming in here, you're not working here. And it's like, and sometimes, quite a lot of times, there will be some guys who's telling me like, nah, do you know what vinyl is? Like, oh my God, okay. You know, stuff like that. And I was like, okay, so I have two options, give up or open my own record store. So I opened my own record store.
Really?
During pandemic.
Okay.
During pandemic, because you know what? Life is too easy. So let's make it a little bit spicy and open a record store during pandemic, because that's when the best time to open a new record store. It's a pop-up record store. I did a pop-up record store, Take Away Jazz Records, and it was like private appointments in Nottingham. And it was only for a specific period of time. But yeah, it was a lot of fun. But I had all the experience from applying for jobs in record store to owning my own record store, you know. So this is how I see now, and this is how I like to do things now. If something doesn't work, build it.
Sure. I mean, like, you know, when you were talking about, you know, going to, you know, band tryouts and it's just dudes and they want a female bass player, it doesn't sound like you were that intimidated, I have to say. That's not the kind of vibe you were giving off when you were telling that. So it doesn't sound like the whole thing really intimidates you much at all. Is that fair?
No, I wasn't, because I was going there to share creativity. No, I don't know. I wasn't. But how I was feeling is because we were putting me in the box of like bass player from Sonic Youth.
Yeah, sure.
Bass player from My Bloody Valentine. And that was more worrying to me. And I see the same happening in electronic music. So if we put in, like, I can't really like think about example like now. I should have prepared more. I'm sure there's millions of examples, but I'm just saying I wasn't intimidated being in that space, but I didn't appreciate the label to put on me straight away. This is what I am.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of drill down a bit more on what you were just saying about how the way things are now, I think you're absolutely right that there is a, I mean, this, I think this is true for the whole of the dance scene though. So I think there are like very specific roles that the artists, quote unquote artists, DJs are expected to fit into. And I think the quote unquote female, the female DJs who've become really, really successful, I think largely can fall into a certain category, which is, you know, definable in the same way that the male DJs who are successful do too, in a slightly different way. I mean, does that kind of make sense to you, that characterization?
Can you give me example of...
Let's call out some famous female DJs, shall we? Yeah, okay. No, so, like, no. you know, Amelie Lawns and Charlotte DeVitt, you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, and, I do, but I don't understand what you mean by they fall into specific category. What's the categories we're talking about?
Well, it's the female version of the big room techno superstar. Right, it's okay. it's very, I think, predictable. Like the way they are marketed. Let's put it that way. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, no, now I understand. I just wanted to really deconstruct your thought.
My incendiary take. Yeah, right.
Yeah, your take on this, but I guess it's the same. You know, when people see changes happening, and maybe some people want to monetize on that. Mm. And I don't mean in a bad way. I mean, there's someone...
No, it's how it works, right?
Yeah, it's someone who is excited playing music. I'm pretty sure Amelie Lenz was playing like a lot of gigs before she got to this level. And there's a lot of DJs, like Peggy Goo as well, was playing a lot of gigs before she became what she is now. And then... As I said, like, we can go back to when you're 16 and you get signed and you get a team around you and you get pushed and there's money invested. And I think it's the same process. And I think it's because change of time and people more start vocalizing, maybe we are missing something, maybe we can make some changes. And changes start happening by creating your own door, creating your club nights, creating, you know, presence online. And I think that's the changes we're seeing. So I don't think it's... I think I answered your question.
Okay. Okay. So this is the second quote I have, which is not from you.
Who's it from?
Fits quite neatly into what you just said. So it's Annie Mack, and this is from the introduction to DJ Paulette's book, who I interviewed on the show last week, and I picked out this quote to her. Because I have to say, tell me what you think. So she's talking about this issue and she says, change has begun, but the pace is glacial. So she thinks that, you know, there's not really a lot has changed, I think is basically what she's saying. And I have to say, I don't agree with that at all. I think a lot has changed in the last, let's call it 5, 6, 7 years. I think it's fundamentally different I'm not even thinking about established artists. I'm thinking about people coming in to people trying to break through in with their music. Tell me, how do you react?
What my thoughts are on this. I agree with you. Things have changed a lot. I've seen a lot of changes, and I think it's to do with maybe social media access and rise of platforms like Boiler Room. And again, when you're seeing someone who's representing you, it kind of gives you more push to go for that.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of that. But I do see changes. I do. I have. So, and I agree with you.
Okay, that's good. So the context is that this issue, as discussed with Paulette last week, was I think it's very different when, because she's the generation older than us, mm-hmm. right? So she was coming through in the 80s and 90s, and I think like she was very involved in the industry in the 90s, and I think really there has been a gradual change, and I think the change has really sped up, like I said, in the last 5 or 6 years. But I think particularly working in the music industry of the 90s and the 80s must have been awful as a woman. It really must have been.
Potentially, I don't know. I haven't been in the 80s and 90s woman, so I can only talk about being a woman in present and last, how long I've been involved in electronic music and band music so professionally, like 7 years, 8 years.
Sure.
So I can, and I have seen difference, a lot of difference. Even I did, when I was in Berlin, I actually did the work experience at a booking agency, which run by a woman. And on her agency was only DJs identified as men, male DJs.
Mm-hmm.
But now her agency is more than half women. And I think I remember was kind of recommending her or talking about something about women DJs, but the conversation was not really happening.
Mm.
And again, it could be, I don't know, for many different reasons. Maybe it was not the time, and time was just beginning to change, and now it's changed and people accepted as normal and moving forward, and now it's developing further.
Sure.
So that could be the case.
Well, I mean, I think that, well, like a booking agency, that's really the sharp end of it, right? So that's like a very kind of commercially oriented kind of judgment as to who is going to get work, right? I mean, that's the nature of a booking agency. So I think the change towards wanting to have representation on lineups, like a commercial change in that way, I think, you know, when that became really important for venues to be making meaningful progress on that issue, I mean, that's...
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think it's media, social media driving them, because again, when you see something, you start questioning, hold on, actually, it will be cool to get more women booked on lineup. And also with the DJs, I had some conversation with people. I remember playing in France for a promoter, and he was saying to me, like, there's not, it was a few years back as well. So a few years back, he was saying to me, there's just not many female DJs. And that conversation, a lot of time met with anger or some kind of judgment. And I was saying to him, like, you know, that's cool. I can recommend you a lot with different kind of sounds. Like, let me email you and I'll tell you the list, and it'll be great to see you book in more women. Because it's important to have this conversation, because if someone's saying, I don't know where to look, or I don't know how to find, but you also want to be part of a change, then you have to step forward, because someone is saying, you know, I want to change, I just don't know how, or, you know, it could be due to laziness because you're like, okay, open the internet or go somewhere. But if you surround yourself with specific teams or people or media, so you might not break through. And then someone comes in and asks you this, and you're like, okay, you know, like, let's talk, let's open this conversation. I think it's very important. And I think that's changes as well. People asking maybe more openly about questions, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So last question, or last area of discussion anyway.
Last area of discussion. Okay, let's go.
What is people's problem with tech house?
You know what? I was thinking, will you ask me a question about cancel culture? And
I would argue that this is linked to cancel culture, but carry on.
Well, are you canceling me because I like tech house? Wait, I have to say, I did interview at the Tech Magazine, and it triggered you, my quote about the track I Wish I Wrote. Like, for anyone who's listening, this, like, Paul wrote on my social media, my Instagram, some comments.
Did I?
I wouldn't say the hate comments. We're not hate. I don't believe Paul is a hateful person.
Not a hater.
But he reacted. Let's say he reacted.
Wow, triggered. What was it that I was triggered by?
So the question was which song you wish you wrote? And I said, Cola by Camel Fat. And I said, because I think it's a Bohemian Rhapsody of contemporary dance music. And I think you lost your shit.
You're triggered now hearing it again. I'm furious to hear that. Beside myself with rage and anger.
Well, I can only take responsibility for my own feelings. And Paul, what can I say? You allowed to feel how you feel. You know, that's your way. But I think my comment was, about from, it's a fun track. I don't know if you listened to it. I'll send it to you after this. So you have to put it into this program so everyone can listen. And there's more streams on the track. It's a fun track. There's something about it, but it's also like has what, like 400 million streams. I think there's something about it.
I mean, that was not my point. That's not an indication of anything in terms of its quality. I have to say, I'm going to pull you up on that.
Listen. I don't disagree with you, but I see things differently.
Okay. But let's return to my original question. Why is it?
Go on.
That people hate tech house so much.
I can't answer for everyone. You're asking me like to tell you about how people feel in the 80s and 90s. Why people hate tech house? I think to me, it's because there is so much judgment, and because I'm in a scene as well as you are in a scene where it's like techno or how it's produced music. So when you see something else, which may be more fun, tech house is fun, it might be being looked down on or something like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Obviously it's comparison of like, oh, this is not cool tech house. I mean, tech house is so much different kind of tech house, you know, as well. Like, but people see it as like Ibiza, you know, like, and if you go to Berghain and when you say, oh, Ibiza, by the way, DC10 doing what? Massive techno parties with biggest DJs, you know, really hard techno. I don't know how it's going down because I think maybe it would be a little bit like too much for someone who's in Ibiza, but when, I don't know. But still, maybe it's also like influenced by changes. And now maybe tech house really start liking techno. And then maybe some people from techno start moving into tech house. But your question, I don't know why people hate tech house. I love tech house.
See, I think it's because there is a perception that lower class people like tech house.
Oh, I don't think lower class. I think different group of people.
I think it's people who are perceived to be socially inferior are perceived to like that music.
I don't know. I never thought about it like that, but maybe it was more to do with like being popular. So techno is like underground, but tech house is very popular. So it's more like opposite. We are underground. We're really like cool. And we go to like dark clubs where you can't take pictures.
I mean, there's definitely
people go sure. And taking photos and selfies. But then again, like I think times changed a lot. There's what you see. Techno is everywhere now. So is it underground still? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right to say that. That's also an element of it. And the kind of business techno kind of snootiness was also part of that same thing. You know, this isn't really techno. It's not really underground techno. It's this kind of, mainstream version of it, you know?
Yeah. And it's also like, oh God, there's so many different kinds of techno as well. Like to me are like, yeah, 2015, 2010, like dub techno, like darker sound, which is more slower. What is popular now? People listen to all kind of stuff, you know? So like to a lot of people, what I listen to would not necessarily be counted as techno because I say that's not techno but doesn't mean they're wrong. It just means they might not experience that or we, you know, didn't look deep into that, but this is what I like. And I think maybe it's, by being music producer, you take more interest in all kind of genres from all different ages. And you also experience that. So you're talking about living in Berlin up to 2015. So your experience of techno is very different to what it is like now to people living in Berlin.
I mean, I have been to a club since 2015.
Yeah, no, I understand. That was not my point. But yes, you get me, yeah.
Absolutely. Listen, this has been really fun. Thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been great.
Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. And to anyone who's listening, please go and check out Caller by Camel Fat. It's Paul's favorite track.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to go and listen to that right now. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that was Machine Woman. What a fun conversation. What an interesting person. Great to get to dig into some of that detailed stuff from her backstory, which I don't think she's talked about too much in interviews before. And tech house. Hey, what about that tech house? Anyway, as I mentioned at the top, I need to keep this brief. Remember to follow the show wherever you listen to this podcast. Follow the Spotify playlist as well. There's a link in the show notes to that playlist. And join us on Patreon to get rid of the ads. I will see you back here, same time, same place next week for the next episode of the Not a Diving Podcast. Thank you.
Podcast with Scuba.